previously.
Another thing I get is also if somebody's a vegetarian and they often ask about their diet, what should they do? And I usually tell them tofu and dairy. Tofu can take some use to. I've been married like 13 years and my husband's a vegetarian. We're vegetarian and I still can't get him to eat tofu, even though I've like tried every single way to prepare it. I've snuck it into food and he still can pick it out. So
this is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370. Online worldwide at talk1370.com.
Well, hey, Austin. Welcome to Beyond the Birds and Bees with Texas Fertility Center. I'm Dr. Kalen Silverberg, and I'm joined today by my partner, Dr. Thomas Vaughn.
Good afternoon.
We are live in Austin. It's approximately noon on January the 29th. It's a Saturday. A little bit, partly cloudy. It was overcast driving over here, but it's a little bit partly cloudy now, and hopefully we're going to avoid that rain until much later in the day. And I've got a couple of patients who've got birthday parties for their kiddos this weekend, and they were all talking to me over the weekend and or during the weekend, hoping that the rain didn't come on. We've got an interesting show today, and the good news is we are not going to pick up where Dr. Mehta and Dr. Berger left off talking about tofu.
Yeah, can we skip the tofu?
Yeah,
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, well, considering I feel kind of like Dr. Mehta's husband, Danny, because I don't eat tofu either. But anyway, what we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about a lot of different things. We're going to start off with a discussion of genetic testing. We're going to talk about genetic testing even before people try and conceive, and then how we can use it during the whole process of in vitro fertilization, how we can select really good quality embryos. And then we're going to move into a discussion of really the latest things that are happening with fertility with our field.
I think that's a great way to start. And just to remind everyone, our website, txfertility.com, has a wealth of material on it as well. And please don't hesitate to look at that. Don't hesitate to call us. We're at 390-1370. We'd love to hear from you at talkradio1370.com on the computer, on the internet. But this concept of genetic testing is just a really great way to get ready for a pregnancy. For instance, there are patients who may be carriers of a recessive gene, which they would not know. No one would really know unless they actually became pregnant with a man that carried the same recessive gene. Then they may have a baby that actually has a disease process.
Sure. I think one of the easiest ways to think about this is sickle cell. And if you think about sickle cell disease, you know, you have to, in order to have a baby with sickle cell disease, the man has to have sickle cell. He has to have an abnormal gene for hemoglobin, a particular type of hemoglobin that's abnormal. And his partner, the woman, has to have the exact same gene. And if they have a baby together, then let's assume for argument's sake that the man has one abnormal gene and one normal gene, and the woman has one normal gene and one abnormal gene. So they each have what's called sickle cell trait. So two normal genes means you're normal. One normal gene and one abnormal gene means you're a carrier. In this case, you have sickle cell trait. And two abnormal genes means that you actually have the disease. So in this case, you would have sickle cell disease. And as most people know, sickle cell disease is really a debilitating, can be life-threatening, can actually be a fatal disease. So in this case, we've got a guy who's got a trait, and we've got the woman who's got the trait, and they have a kid together with each other. So there is a 1 in 4 chance that that baby will get the normal gene from the man and the normal gene from the woman and be totally unaffected.
And then the gene stops. That's not passed on at all.
Exactly right. So that baby, as he grows up or she grows up and they have children, they have no way of passing that on because they did not inherit the abnormal gene. So now you've got a baby who's got the 1 in 4 chance of being totally unaffected, and it's all over. So that baby doesn't have sickle cell trait, doesn't have sickle cell disease. That baby's normal. That baby has a 1 in 4 chance also of getting both the abnormal gene from the father and the abnormal gene from the mother. So now that baby has sickle cell disease. It's got two abnormal genes and no normal genes. And when that baby has children of his or her own, it's guaranteed that he will pass or she will pass on one abnormal gene to that baby. So if you've got a person who's got sickle cell disease, at a minimum, all of their children will have sickle cell trait. And if he marries somebody or has children with somebody who has sickle cell trait or sickle cell disease also, it can only get worse from there. So all of that child's offspring will at least have sickle cell trait. So meanwhile, just to recap, you've got a 1 in 4 chance that you'd have a normal baby, 1 in 4 chance you'd have a baby with sickle cell disease, and a 2 out of 4 chance, it's just basic math, that that child would have sickle cell trait. In other words, be just like the parents. And sickle cell trait can even be debilitating under certain circumstances, high altitude, low oxygen concentrations. The cells, the red cells in the bloodstream change shape, and they're no longer as capable of carrying oxygen as normal red cells, and that can lead to all kinds of problems.
Injury of organs, pain, it is really not a good disease at all. And what we're talking about is trying to identify that risk before the patient becomes pregnant. We have seen patients in our practice who have discovered that they carry a recessive gene and have a child with the disease and have presented to us so that they can prevent that in the future. And what we're trying to do is to encourage all of our patients that come to us to become pregnant to do some testing to learn if they carry any of these recessive genes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because, you know, until 2 or 3 years ago, if you wanted to come in to be screened to make sure that you can decrease your likelihood of having an abnormal pregnancy, first of all, it was very expensive because the only tests that could be performed were blood tests, and there were complicated tests to perform, very difficult. The labs frequently would have to send blood out to specialized labs around the country because there were very few labs that would do these things. And then the other really important thing was, what are you screening for? You know, how many different diseases do you look for? I mean, we know that if you're in certain ethnic groups or certain populations, you're at an increased risk of having certain conditions. So, for example, if you're Greek or Italian, you come from the Mediterranean, we can screen for certain types of blood disorders, G6PD, dehydrogenase deficiency. You can screen for Fanconi's anemia, certain other types of disorders.
Thalassemias.
If you are African American, we'd screen you for sickle cell disease. If you're Ashkenazi Jewish population, you get screened for Tay-Sachs disease, Canavan's disease, a bunch of other different conditions. But the question really is, you know, who do you screen and what are you looking for? And there were no real panels. In other words, we would have to draw your blood for each individual test, and it would be thousands and thousands of dollars just to get that screening done.
And I think that this offer that we have to be able to screen for 109 recessive genes with a company called Counsyl allows us to do more broad screening of patients.
Yeah, and it's so simple because what happens now is patients come in and we give them a test tube, or they can get the test tube online. You can go to Counsyl, C-O-U-N-S-Y-L .com, and you can get a kit from them. And it costs $349.
That's a bargain.
Which is incredible, to screen for 109 different diseases. And so for essentially $700, $698, both members of the couple can get screened. So we can screen the woman, we can screen the man. And we know that there's only a potential problem if both members of the couple have the same genetic abnormality. So, you know, just when you think about it out of chance, just statistics, you know, the odds are pretty good that if you get screened, you're going to come up positive for something. But it's only a problem if your partner comes up positive for the exact same thing.
Right.
And, you know, granted, it's a little more complicated than that, because if you look at cystic fibrosis, for example, there are numerous abnormalities. There are over 100 abnormalities now, 100 different genetic abnormalities for cystic fibrosis. So in the old days, we thought if the guy's got cystic fibrosis genetic abnormality and if the woman's got the genetic abnormality and they have a kiddo together, we've got big trouble. But in fact, now with over 100 different specific abnormalities for cystic fibrosis, the man may be a carrier of one abnormality, the woman may be carrier of the other abnormality, so even though they're both considered carriers, they can actually have a baby that's not affected.
Yes, and I think that this is just really helpful, because remember, these people are basically normal. And what we do is we offer this usually to the woman, and if she is completely negative, there's really not a need to screen the husband, because it would be for the same recessive genes. He may learn that he has one, but it really is insignificant if his wife doesn't have the same recessive gene.
That's exactly right. And so it's really important. It's an incredible opportunity. And the American College of OB-GYN now has actually come out with guidelines suggesting that all couples who are trying to conceive be screened. It's not necessary to screen you for everything under the sun, but now for $350 essentially, to screen you for 109 different genetic diseases, it's just a no-brainer. And as Dr. Vaughn said, we've been working with a company called Counsyl. There's another company that's going to come out on the market with their test very soon called Good Start Genetics. This is a company that we've done a little bit of work with before. They're out of MIT, really, really bright guys. And they've developed a different technology that is perhaps a little more accurate and maybe even a little more extensive than the Counsyl Corporation testing. So it's really incredible. There's just some great opportunities now. But like I was saying before, instead of doing blood tests, it's not even a blood test. You just get a test tube. You actually produce some saliva or you spit into the test tube. You seal it and you send it off to California. And in a couple of weeks, you get the answers back. And then there's genetic counseling that's included in that $349. So if you turn out to have an abnormality, you'll get a visit, a free visit, or a visit that's already been paid for over the telephone with a genetic counselor who can give you advice as to what needs to be to happen from there, if anything.
And for these couples, if they do have a recessive gene that matches up, of course they can take their chances. That's not what we recommend. But options would be to actually undergo in vitro fertilization, evaluate the embryos. If we find one that has the disease, to transfer one that does not have the disease. And another option would be to substitute for the sperm or the egg. Usually couples are not very interested in that, but it is an option.
Sure, and the good news is that we've got choices and we've got options that we can present to couples. And that's one of the coolest things I think about our specialty is that even though our specialty hasn't been around for a very long time, we've only been around for less than 30 years, there are unbelievable advances that are occurring every single week. Well, Thomas, I know we're coming up against a break, so how about if we stop this discussion now and let's go on to a break, and then we will pick up where we left off on the other side of the break with Beyond the Birds and Bees from Texas Fertility.
Talk 1370, the right choice for weekends.
We're back. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with Dr. Kaylin Silverberg from the Texas Fertility Center. This is our hour on Saturdays from 12 to 1 with Beyond the Birds and the Bees. And we've been talking about genetic testing, but I just want to make a couple of announcements before we get back to that. One is that we have the TFC Peer Support Group that meets on February the 15th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. There's an IVF orientation on February the 9th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And Dr. Lisa Hanschert, one of our partners, is going to be doing that presentation, and it's a free presentation. It's just great. The slides are really good. Everybody has always given us positive feedback about this orientation, which we've done for years on a monthly basis. And, Kaylin, I hear that Lisa's going to be on television.
She is. She is. It's so funny. Lisa is very telegenic, very photogenic, and she's got a very engaging personality. And so I guess the Fox News people couldn't stay away from her. So she's actually going to be on the Fox Morning News show on a week from Monday. So 9 days from today, on the 8th of February, she'll be on in the morning. And she's actually got a very interesting topic. It's with a lot of the stuff in the news lately about stars from Hollywood having babies and how they're having babies in little different ways. Nicole Kidman, I think, was on most recently that she had a baby without actually carrying the child herself. Right. She used a gestational carrier. And Lisa is going to be on the show, I think, with one of her patients who is a gestational carrier or who conceived using a gestational carrier. And they're going to talk about a little less conventional ways of conceiving, but things that are certainly very workable and things that we do very, very successfully in our practice.
And very important if a woman's had a hysterectomy or something like that.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely.
Before we go further, though, we do have a phone call from Oz, I believe on line one.
How y'all doing?
Good. We're doing fine. How about you?
Doing great, man. I listen to the show a lot, and I really enjoy what y'all have.
Well, thank you very much. Would you repeat that one more time? No, I'm just kidding. We're glad you listen to it a lot.
Yeah, I have a question. Me and my girlfriend, we're trying to have a kid, and what kind of foods would boost her fertility?
Well, we recommend that people eat well, particularly to be sure that women are as normal weight as they can be. In other words, not be too heavy and not be too thin. Once a patient is well-nourished, there's really not any particular food that will boost her fertility. And I must say that it is important that every woman of reproductive age who is it's possible for them to become pregnant needs to be taking folic acid, not to boost fertility, But to decrease the risk of a birth defect called spina bifida, which is not a really good thing to have. So we really do want to avoid that if we can. So be sure that she has taken her folic acid.
And she also needs to have enough protein. So I don't know if she's a vegetarian or if she's not a vegetarian, but regardless, even vegetarians can, there's certain supplements they can take and certain types of food they can eat to make sure they've got enough protein, make sure they have enough vitamins and iron. A well-rounded prenatal vitamin is also critically important, as Dr. Vaughn was saying, to make sure that she has enough folic acid. But as far as any other types of food, it's more foods that we recommend that people avoid. So, for example, we would avoid, you know, she may be a big sushi fan, and that's great when she's not trying to get pregnant, but we certainly avoid, or we certainly recommend that patients avoid eating raw meat, avoid eating raw fish, because all those things can potentially be problematic.
And you know, one other thing, too, is that think about if she enjoys eating fish, to think about maybe Googling that fish to be sure there's not a high mercury content in it, like mackerel, for instance. And that is another food that's worthwhile avoiding. And there's other things to avoid that aren't really in the diet, like smoking, and don't go overboard on caffeine and yeah, alcohol, things like that.
Yeah, I cut her off that.
The problem is you can't make her miserable, you know, because she's got to still have some fun in life. And you know, the good news is that the overwhelming majority of people get pregnant and pregnancies progress beautifully without too much intervention. I mean, it's one of those natural things that can happen naturally. That's great. And we're here for situations when nature doesn't go the way that we'd like for it to.
Of course, yes.
Well, listen, good luck to you.
All right, thank you, man.
You bet.
Helped out a lot.
Well, sure, appreciate it. Thanks for listening, and thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Yep. So what we were talking about right before our caller was the gestational carrier that Dr. Hanscher is going to be talking about. And again, this is where when something's broken, so to speak, the uterus won't work either because it's been scarred from too many surgeries or whatever, or had to be removed for cancer or bleeding problems that couldn't be controlled, then it is reasonable to be able to utilize someone else to carry their baby for them, not just necessarily for convenience, but because the woman's uterus won't work. So this really is a great option for women and couples in this situation.
You know, we've also had situations, Thomas, where I know I've had some, and I know you've had some too, where patients even have a uterus, and their uterus may work, but they've got chronic diseases, and people have advised them not to get pregnant. For example, I've got patients with severe diabetes, and diabetes is just a potentially devastating condition, and their blood sugars are very tenuous as they are, and we know that during pregnancy, blood sugars can really go haywire, and so their physicians advise them not to get pregnant. They used a gestational carrier, and fortunately were successful. And there are other conditions, you know, cardiovascular conditions where patients may have had heart surgery or they may have had surgery on their aorta, big blood vessel, and it may not be safe for them to get pregnant, or maybe while it's safe for them to get pregnant, it may not be safe for them to go through labor and or delivery. And so those are, you know, gestational carrier is a great option for that as well. And, you know, this is just another option, another example, rather, of things that we do that are really cutting edge. And there's so many things that are out there. We were on the track of talking really about genetics, mm-hmm. and you had just started to get into a discussion about pre-implantation genetic screening. So you want to pick up there?
Yeah, I think this is just a really good option for couples that we know have genetic abnormalities. And there's two situations in which you do evaluation. One is in a situation called aneuploidy, and that basically means you have too many chromosomes or too few, which usually leads to a miscarriage. So we can utilize this in women or in couples that have a recurrent pregnancy losses. But what we talked about earlier, and when we introduced the subject, Dr. Silverberg was talking about sickle cell anemia. This is called a single gene defect, where the number of chromosomes are normal, but you're looking for a very specific abnormality in or an abnormal gene. And what happens is that once the embryo is made, once the sperm penetrates the egg and it grows, that our embryologists are able to remove one of the cells when it's about an 8-cell embryo and evaluate it and get the answer back within 2 days when the embryo is transferred back to the woman.
Yeah, it's really an amazing technology because at minimal risk to the embryo, and certainly any time you take a cell out of an embryo, you do run the risk, but is really minimal. And to be able to take that cell out, to be able to put that cell on a microscope slide, and then treat that cell so that it opens up and it releases the chromosomes, and then the chromosomes can actually be stained so we can identify a specific defect within that chromosome that's abnormal that can lead to something like sickle cell, or we can stain it in a different way to actually look for the presence or absence of the entire chromosome. So we can make sure that every embryo or every cell has 46 chromosomes like it should have, one X and one Y if it's male, or two X's if it's female. And the technology is really, it's just phenomenal.
It's just really amazing how we can get this result within about 40 hours from the time that we do the biopsy. And we've had patients ask when they have an amniocentesis, and it takes very many weeks to get a result, we can get a little faster because we're really looking at one cell.
Yeah, and the other thing is that now there are other technologies that are just coming on online where we can actually do things that are even less invasive or less aggressive. So, for example, embryos can now be biopsied on day 5. And at that point in time, you do what's called a trophectoderm biopsy. So you don't have to drill a hole into the embryo itself to remove a cell, but rather, you know, because if you're looking on day 3, for example, we're trying to take one cell out of an embryo that may have as few as 6 cells or may have as many as 12 cells. But with trophectoderm biopsy, there are literally millions of cells, and we can take out just a few of those and look at those under the microscope and evaluate those cells as well.
And it would make sense that if you're taking a lower percentage of cells to be evaluated, that the embryo is more likely to do well through that biopsy procedure.
Sure. And the fact that, you know, typically you can do trophectoderm biopsy on day 5, and then you can actually either freeze that embryo and transfer it in a later cycle or potentially transfer it on day 6. And now there are a couple of programs that are experimenting with actually doing biopsy on day 5 and through a rapid assay being able to still transfer those embryos on day 5.
And the technology just continues to grow. Yeah. And the options and opportunities for couples just is growing exponentially.
Right. And I know that we're getting ready to start a study. Actually, we have just started a brand new study. And we'll talk about research a little bit more in just a couple of minutes. But one thing that we are doing now is we're doing a brand new research study with a company out of Massachusetts where we are looking at something called embryo markers. So we believe that there may very well be specific markers that are exhibited within a cell, within an embryo, a very early embryo, that will allow us to predict the likelihood of that embryo working, whether it can attach, whether it won't attach, whether it will grow, whether it won't grow. And we really think that some of those markers are expressed even before fertilization. So at the stage where the embryo doesn't even exist, it's actually just an egg. And so patients who come through our IVF program now are being offered an opportunity to participate in this study. They go through in vitro fertilization just like normal. When we get the eggs out, in addition to the egg, in the fluid that we pull out of the ovary, there are millions of other cells called granulosa cells. Ordinarily, we take the egg out, and that's what we add the sperm to fertilize, and we throw those granulosa cells away. So we take those millions of cells and just throw them in the garbage because they're not going to contribute to pregnancy. In this particular study, we get patients' permission to freeze those cells, send those cells off so that they can be tested, and then we track each separate egg individually to find out what happens to it. So some eggs don't fertilize. Well, that's important to know because we're going to screen those cells that we've taken away from that egg with specific markers to try and identify which markers may indicate in advance that an egg won't fertilize. Some eggs fertilize fine, but then they start to fall apart. Some eggs fertilize abnormally. And again, we're going to get the opportunity to look at those markers and see which markers go up or which markers go down and correlate that back with the egg itself.
You know, this is such a good study because there is zero risk to the woman participating in this or the couple participating. There is no risk. Just envision that we aspirate the fluid from in the ovary that contains the egg. It's put into a dish, a petri dish. The embryologist finds the egg, takes the egg out, and immediately moves it to another dish that has special growth media to enhance the further development of this egg. That dish where the egg left is literally thrown in the trash. And what the couples have decided, have given us permission to utilize these cells to look for these biomarkers. So there is zero risk. What a great study where there's no risk to the couple to learn a lot of information that will be very, very beneficial in the future. We're just really excited to be part of this. This is truly a cutting-edge study.
It really is, and we're certainly the only program in Central Texas that's doing this. I know of one other program in the whole state that's actually participating in this trial, but it's a nationwide study, and you know, I think it speaks well of the practice because this company that's conducting the study went to they could have gone to any practice in the country because people would be standing in line to do a study like this. But it's just an example of industry and practices working hand-in-hand because we could never afford to do this study. No medical practice could really afford to do a study like this, not only from a financial perspective, but we don't have access to that technology. So there are companies that we can partner with who have access to the technology, but they don't have a medical practice, so they don't have patients. So it really works out very, very well so that these companies can actually provide the technology. The technology is proven. We've actually seen it. And so we know that the technology works. We know that it's not harmful to embryos whatsoever. In fact, the embryos are not even touched. It's just the cells that we would have otherwise discarded that we use for this. And then we can provide the patients. So it's really just an example of a strategic partnership that works incredibly well for our patients.
And, you know, when we do in vitro fertilization, our goal is to have one baby, get one baby from the procedure. And if you have a couple going through that, say, 35 to 39 years old, in general, you would tend to transfer two or three embryos. Still, the goal is to get one. So that tells you that if we could look at an embryo and say, that's a baby, we'd only put in one. But as anyone who's looked at IVF knows that you generally put in more than one embryo, and particularly when women are a little bit older, it tells you that no matter how good we think we are, we can't always determine which embryo is going to give us a baby and which one is not going to give us a baby. You can't tell a book by its cover sometime.
I know.
So this biomarker will allow us to do that, and the ultimate success will be lowering the risk of multiple births.
Sure, and also decreasing the chance of abnormalities, because we know that from lots of studies that we've been done, or that have been done, some of which we've been a part of, we know that 60% or approximately 60% of gorgeous embryos on day three, you know, you look at these embryos and you think, oh my gosh, that embryo could be on the cover of a textbook. I mean, it tells you how nerdy we are that we think about these things, but you know, that embryo could be on the cover of a textbook. It's beautiful. It's got equal round cells. It's got no fragmentation. Everything looks perfect. We know there's still a 60 to 65% chance in women 35 years of age or younger that that embryo is chromosomally abnormal. In other words, that embryo is destined to not attach, or if it does attach, God forbid, to miscarry, because it's chromosomally abnormal and it has an abnormality that's not compatible with life. I mean, something not even like Down syndrome, which, you know, potentially could be devastating, sometimes not, but potentially could be devastating. This is even worse than Down syndrome, because these are embryos where the children have no chance of being born alive, or if they do survive to being born, they have no chance of ever developing. They die at a very early age. In women who are 40 years of age or older, we know that 90% of beautiful day three embryos are chromosomally abnormal. And so by being able to look at these things in advance, we can determine which embryos to transfer, which embryos not to transfer. So let me give you a classic example. We have a 35, 36-year-old woman. She goes through IVF with her husband. They make 8 beautiful embryos. Well, which of those embryos do we transfer? We're not going to transfer all 8 embryos. I mean, that's been done, to our knowledge, one time, and that guy got in massive trouble and lost his medical license. So, you know, we comply with all the guidelines that are put out by the national organizations and compatible with the law, but we would only transfer 1 or 2 embryos. So which 1 or 2 do we put in? You know, we did a study in our practice several years ago that we presented at the American Fertility Society meeting, where we actually had our embryologists look at all of a patient's embryos on day 3, and they ranked them in order, you know, 1 through however many beautiful embryos there were. And then they put those embryos back in the incubators, grew them for 2 more days, took that piece of paper where they had ranked them and put them in a drawer. And 2 days later, on day 5, they took those embryos out of the incubator, picked the 1 or 2 embryo they were actually going to transfer, and again ranked them in order. And we then compared, at the end of having done this on a couple hundred patients, we compared the results to see how good we were. And our embryologists are world class. But we wanted to compare how good we were at predicting on day 3 and on day 5 which embryos we would have transferred. And what we found was that half the time we would have picked the wrong embryos on day 3 to transfer. And this is one reason why sometimes if we've got good prognosis couples who've got lots of beautiful embryos, we try and encourage them to let us grow the embryos to day five, not only so we can transfer fewer embryos, but so that there's a greater likelihood that the embryos that we're going to transfer are actually normal.
And some of those embryos that would have been selected for transfer on day three not only did not develop well enough to look good on day five, but some of them just quit growing.
Yeah,
it would have just been a negative pregnancy test. So it's pretty interesting, all the dynamics with embryo growth over the 5 to 6 day period of time.
And what PGS allows us to do, the technique you were talking about a minute ago where we can biopsy the embryo, it allows us to have more than just a visual appearance of an embryo. So we talk to our patients about, you know, that embryo selection is kind of like the Miss America pageant, but all you have to go by is the evening gown competition. You know, we're looking to see what does this embryo look like under a microscope. And sometimes, you know, Miss North Carolina, who may be the most beautiful in an evening gown, may not be able to string five words together and make a sentence, and she may not end up becoming Miss America, maybe somebody else. And similar to the embryo that looks the most beautiful under the microscope may not have normal DNA or normal chromosomes, and it has no chance of going on to become a baby. So I know we're up against another break, and I know we need to take some time out. Again, this is Dr. Kalen Silverberg, Dr. Thomas Vaughn with Texas Fertility. Our phone number, if you want to call in, is 390-1370. And we hope that you will join us on the other side of the break.
Talk 1370, the right choice for weekends.
Good afternoon again. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with my partner, Dr. Kalen Silverberg. We're in the hour from noon to one with our show Beyond the Birds and the Bees. We're both from the Texas Fertility Center. Our website's txfertility.com. Don't hesitate to visit this website. It has a wealth of material. And what we're trying to do is to get as much information out for education of patients who want to know as much as they can about infertility, difficulties conceiving. What we've been talking about today is a little bit of genetic screening. In fact, we call this PGS, which is pre-implantation genetic screening. If you've been reading the internet, you may see it as PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, but it's really just a screening technique. And so when you look, you'll know that both of these are kind of used interchangeably. And that's what we have been talking about. We are happy that we can offer this service. It has really been a great value, particularly for couples that have genetic abnormalities where you want to select an embryo that does not have a particular disease to avoid having a child with a problem and also passing on that gene.
Well, Thomas, I think that there's a lot of other things that we're doing in our program that are really exciting and really new, certainly new to Central Texas and really, to be frank, new to Texas. And another thing that we're doing now is we have the ability to freeze eggs. You know, for years and years and years, we've had the ability to freeze sperm. And donor sperm has been real popular. It's been used to produce pregnancies for decades now. We've also had the ability to freeze embryos. But unfortunately, the egg is a lot more complicated than sperm or embryos. It's, you know, my wife frequently says it's about her. And when it comes to pregnancy, it really is about the woman. It's really about the egg because sperm are almost a dime a dozen. I mean, you know, if you look in a typical ejaculate, you may have anywhere from 10 million sperm to several hundred million sperm, and that's per ejaculate. But per month, a woman on her own is just going to ovulate one egg, and so that egg is just so important. And it's been easy to freeze sperm for years and years because if you freeze 50 million sperm and maybe 40% of them don't survive being frozen and thawed, you're still left with a really good sample. And we know that the sperm recover relatively well. They can still swim around. They can still bind to an egg. They can still cause fertilization. The same thing with embryos. We know when we freeze embryos, if we freeze a 7 or 8 cell embryo, we may only have 5 or 6 cells that survive being frozen. But we know that as long as we have at least one cell that survives, that embryo has a perfectly normal chance of becoming a perfectly healthy, normal child. So the technology has existed for years to be able to freeze sperm and eggs, sperm and embryos. Now, you may say, well, why would you even need to do it? And there's lots of reasons, as you know. I mean, one reason that we need to freeze sperm is because some women are single and they want to have babies and they don't have the partner. They haven't found Mr. Right yet. Some guys have specific diseases for which they've been treated. For example, they may have cancer, they may have gotten cancer chemotherapy, and they may want to freeze some sperm so that in the event that they don't have recovery of their sperm production after their cancer or their chemotherapy, maybe they'll still be able to produce a pregnancy. And the other reason is that to protect people from disease transmission, we need to freeze sperm. And so, you know, if you've got a sperm donor, for example, or you've got a woman who wants to use donor sperm, she wants to be able to have some kind of a guarantee that she's not going to have an increased risk of getting HIV or getting hepatitis B or C or syphilis or anything else from the sperm. And so what we do is when sperm donors come into certain programs, we don't bank sperm for donors, but certain programs do. And when a guy comes in to bank sperm, say he goes to Fairfax, for example, in Austin, Fairfax Cryobank, he would show up, he would get screened and tested, and he would have his blood drawn for a variety of different sexually transmitted diseases. He'd then have his specimen frozen, and 6 months later, he'd be retested. And we know that the six-month period came about because if a guy has been exposed to, you know, God forbid, hepatitis C, there's a substantial likelihood that within 6 months, his blood test would become positive. So if he tests negative before he stores the sperm and tests negative 6 months later, we know that the sperm that he banked initially is safe. And so that sperm can be thawed and it can be transferred into the woman's uterus. But egg freezing has been much, much more of a challenge.
It really has been more of a challenge. I just have to digress. Why do you think we need 20 to 40 million sperm for one egg? Now, if you ask women, they'll tell you that, you know, the sperm get there and most of them get lost and don't ask for directions, right?
Right.
But if you ask the men, they'll say, well, you know, the women are the ultimate shoppers.
Right.
They're going to pick the best one out of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But seriously, freezing the egg has been really, really good for women who are having to undergo chemotherapy, where the chemotherapy may destroy the ovary and destroy egg production. And this allows them to have the opportunity to become pregnant in the future. Also, there is there are women who feel like Mr. Right is not there, and she's worried she's in her mid-30s or so and wants to be able to save her eggs for future. Well, freezing the egg has been difficult, primarily because it's a little bit of a fragile state of meiosis at that time. So the spindles that pull the chromosomes apart where they separate into haploid, which means half, 23 on one side, 23 on the other, can be damaged at that time. So technology has now allowed better techniques to freeze the egg for the future.
Right. And, you know, it's so interesting because there's really two basic populations of patients who are interested in egg freezing. You have patients who want egg freezing just because electively, like you said, they hadn't found Mr. Right. And you have patients who are undergoing cancer chemotherapy. So the oncologists in town, the cancer specialists who we work with, frequently will send us patients who have just tragic stories. I mean, recently diagnosed with breast cancer, recently diagnosed with leukemia, recently diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And these women are getting ready to either have their ovaries removed or chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And we unfortunately know that there's a substantial likelihood that after their therapy, that even though they may very well survive their cancer, their fertility options will be lost. And so we have the ability now to take these eggs out. We stimulate their ovaries very quickly for in vitro fertilization. But rather than fertilize the eggs in vitro, we can actually freeze the eggs. Now, what's special about this? Because you may say, well, you know, I've been reading about this for years. This is nothing new. Well, in fact, what is new is the technique that we're using. Because until about 6 to 9 months ago, we were using a technique called slow freeze. And slow freeze was the best technology that was available at the time. When you freeze an egg, instead of freezing it, we're actually freeze drying it. It's almost like when you make coffee. So what we have to do is, the first thing you do is you dehydrate the egg. Because the egg is loaded with water, you have to take the water out of the egg itself. And you do that by passing the egg into varying concentrations of a sugar-based solution. And the higher the concentration of sugar, the more water gets pulled out of the egg itself. And when that egg has been dehydrated, you replace that water with essentially an antifreeze. And then you put the egg into a machine that's programmed to drop the temperature at a specific rate. And it does this slowly over a period of a couple of hours. And then you plunge that egg, once it's been frozen, into liquid nitrogen where you can store it indefinitely. Well, now some really, really smart people in Atlanta came up with a different kind of technology called vitrification, where you actually freeze the egg so fast that it turns into glass. It's a glass-like state. And the benefit of this is that it's all designed to preserve the DNA, preserve the chromosomes on the inside of the egg, and do the least damage as possible to that chromosome. And so by using this vitrification technique, we're able to freeze more eggs. We're able to freeze them much more successfully. When they thaw, they fertilize at a much higher rate, and the chance of them resulting in a pregnancy and producing a baby is much higher.
Before we go down that path a little bit more, we do have a caller, Michelle from North Austin. Michelle, are you there?
I am. Hi. Good afternoon. I've been listening for a while. I'm a fan of the show. Thanks for having me. And I was just wondering, abortion's been in the news a lot lately, and I'm wondering how you think it relates to this topic and supporting life.
So the question, I'm sorry, I couldn't understand, but you're saying abortion's been in the news lately, and how does this relate to this topic?
Yeah, exactly. This supporting life, it seems like a really viable opportunity to help a lot of people that are actually struggling.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And what we do, you know, without getting going down the religious path here, what we do is we treat every embryo or every egg or every sperm specimen as though it's got the opportunity to produce a life. And so what we are all about is trying to give every possible embryo every possible opportunity using the best available technology to result in a viable, healthy baby.
Great. That sounds great. That's my question. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for the call.
Thanks for the call. So back to vitrification, which is this rapid freeze technique that allows for kind of better survival through the freeze process. We are also doing this with embryos. And we have seen with this new technique that we have more embryos that make it through the freeze and the thaw. And in fact, we on average, 70% of our embryos will make it through the freeze and thaw, but we're even seeing a higher success rate of the survival of that, but also in the pregnancy rate. So this has been just a really, really good new procedure.
Yeah, and I think, again, we're certainly the only program in Central Texas that's offering this. And I know of a couple programs in Houston that are offering it, one program in Dallas that's offering vitrification. But it's really a huge advance. And, you know, to continue this line of thought, there are really several other things that we're doing in our program, one of which we're working with a brand-new company that came out of MIT and Harvard and Stanford. And it's a company called Nora Therapeutics. They're not even on anybody's radar yet. But they have developed a technology that in animals so far increases implantation rates. And implantation is when the embryo actually attaches to the wall of the uterus. And we know that when implantation doesn't occur, there's a lot of reasons that it may not occur. For example, there may be a problem with the uterus. And we try and evaluate our patients very thoroughly before they go through in vitro fertilization to make sure that we've eliminated that possibility. Some embryos don't attach or don't implant because they're chromosomally abnormal. Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, we don't necessarily want embryos to attach when they have no chance of becoming a child anyway. And, you know, it would just result in a later miscarriage. So that's not good. But we also think that sometimes some embryos that are normal don't attach because maybe there's a defect in the receptor for the surface of the uterus, or maybe there's a defect in a receptor that's on the surface of the embryo. So what this technology is developed to do is to minimize the likelihood that normal embryos won't attach. I mean, there's so many negatives in that sentence. Let me try and rephrase it. It is designed to increase the likelihood that all normal embryos will attach to the wall of the uterus. And it's just an amazing technology. Again, we're going to be the only program in Texas that's going to be participating in this trial. And we're hoping this trial is going to get started either in the third or fourth quarter of this year. But if we can direct our patients and our listeners and our callers to go to our website, it's www.txfertility.com. Along the top navigation bar, you'll find a tab that says Research. And if you click on that, you can see what kind of research we do. You can look at current studies. You can look at past studies. In fact, just in the break, Thomas and I were looking. We were both amazed that there are 22 studies that are on here just in the last 10 years or so. And just when you look at the titles of the studies and we know what those products have become and what's come as a result of those studies, it's just amazing that You know, Texas Fertility has been involved since the late 1990s in really groundbreaking research that has changed the way that infertility is practiced. It's changed the way that, minimally invasive surgery has been accomplished. We've certainly been involved in studying all of the new adhesion prevention barriers that are out there to try and minimize the risk of scar tissue formation after surgery. We've been involved in developing and perfecting the techniques and technologies to stimulate patients. And it's just, I'm just so proud, Thomas, when I look at the list of all the things that, we've been, you know, doing.
This is a, such an important part of our practice that we even have an employee, our research coordinator, who's dedicated just to this area of our practice, Tamara Mentor. And she, it's easy to contact her if you have any interest in looking at studies. Some of the studies will also help fund part of the IVF procedure. We don't always have those happening, so to speak, but we do, so don't hesitate to check in with her and see if there's anything that you would be interested in. But this has just been a great part of the practice.
It really has been, and it's given so many patients the opportunity to participate in groundbreaking research for a variety of different reasons. You have to think, okay, now why is somebody going to participate in a research study? I mean, first of all your information is kept confidential. Second of all, you're given the opportunity to participate and potentially receive some products, either drugs or additives or things like that, that could potentially increase your likelihood of conceiving before they're even brought to market. And you have to understand, we're not just, you know, trying to scattershoot and use different additives or different devices out there to see whether or not they work. Everything that we test in the office and in our practice and in the operating room has already been proven to work in what are called preclinical situations. So they've been animal tested. They've usually been tested in humans before. We know that they've certainly been tested in humans for safety. And what we're trying to do is what are called efficacy tests to try and find out, do they really improve pregnancy rates over standard treatment?
And even recently, one of the studies was that we knew, but both techniques work. And this was looking at intramuscular progesterone shot versus a vaginal gel. And we were looking for them to be equal, and it turned to be equal so we could get rid of the shots and make it more comfortable for our patients.
Right, and I do just want to put in a couple of plugs for things that are coming up this week. Again, we've got our peer support group, which is going to be February 15th from 6:30 to 8 o'clock. IVF orientation on the 9th at North Austin Medical Center at 6:30. And Dr. Hanser will be on the news on local Fox station on February the 8th in the morning. And Dr. Natalie Berger will be here next week with Beyond the Birds and Bees. Again, thanks so much for joining Dr. Thomas Vaughn, Dr. Kaylin Silverberg from Texas Fertility.